Understand, we shut down this week sometimes, so savor these moments. There aren't many left. For anyone who is here on Senate Bill 20, if you didn't notice that, it will not be heard today. Sort of become the Harold Stassen bill of the session. And just keep running it up on the agenda. So we will go to work right away on Senate Bill 1205, and I will open a public hearing on that since we've not heard that. Rachel, if I could get the sign-up sheet. Council, if you'll give us the background on that while she's bringing forward the Senate.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 1205A, in addition to declaring legislative findings regarding insurance coverage for a cleanup of polluted sites in Oregon, the bill prescribes rules of construction that would be applicable in the interpretation of any liability, general liability insurance policies involving those environmental claims. And as it came out of the Senate, the three specific rules of construction, if you will, unless the policies themselves dictate otherwise, would be that Oregon law shall be applied in all cases in which the contaminated property is in Oregon, and that voluntary written agreements with the EPA and the DEQ are equivalent to a suit or a lawsuit for the purposes of the interpretation of those words, suit or lawsuit, in a general liability policy. And third, that insurance coverage for any reasonable and necessary fees incurred pursuant to those voluntary agreements would not be denied the insured on the grounds that those expenses were incurred as part of a voluntary payment, not a suit, if you will, not a formal suit under the policy. You have before you the -A10 amendments and the -A12 amendments. The -A12 amendments delete provisions regarding plaintiff's elections of attorney's fees upon these claims going to court, and I think I will allow Mr. DiLorenzo and or Mr. Powell to talk to you about the -A10 amendments themselves.
Okay, let's begin. Mr. DiLorenzo, come on up. And Justin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. With me is Mr. Justin Burns. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Hagen, Dye, Hershey & DiLorenzo in Portland, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of my client, ICM Pharmaceuticals, in support of Senate Bill 1205A. By way of background, in the mid-70s, ICM Pharmaceuticals purchased the United Medical Laboratories operation near the Portland International Airport. United Medical Laboratories had operated the nation's largest mail order pathology laboratory at that site beginning in 1961. ICN ran the laboratory facility from approximately 1972 to 1979. All operations were terminated in late 1979. There was another business concern by the name of Drum Recovery, which operated a drum recycling and waste disposal business in the early 1980s across the street from the ICN lab. Among other things, Drum Recovery shipped hazardous waste materials generated by others to appropriate landfills. During the course of their operation, Drum Recovery was short of working capital and had been locked out of numerous hazardous waste landfills. As a result, the principals of Drum Recovery began employing creative and illegal ways of disposing of their hazardous waste. The principals of Drum Recovery were indicted for federal environmental crimes involving dumping sodium hydroxide at playgrounds and depositing transformers containing PCBs on the ICN property. On this indictment, one of the principals served a significant amount of time in federal prison, and two others were placed on probation. Drum Recovery happened to have in its possession, directly across the street from the ICN site, a significant number of drums containing TCE, or trichloroethylene, destined for disposal somewhere. In the early 1990s, the Portland Development Commission was interested in the acquisition of the ICN site and conducted a number of environmental studies, which indicated the presence of some contaminated soils and other environmental concerns that could be attributed to ICN's operations. Because ICN had an interest in selling the property, and given the fact that that contaminated soils were present, ICN approached the Department of Environmental Quality and volunteered to enter into a cleanup agreement with the DEQ under DEQ supervision. ICN was accepted into the voluntary cleanup program and immediately began addressing the problem. The department divided the site into five operable units, four of which have been completely remediated to DEQ satisfaction. However, during the course of our remedial investigation, ICN discovered, much to its horror, that there were significant quantities of TCE, the trichloroethylene I mentioned, and two of TCE's breakdown products, DCE, dichlorethane, and vinyl chloride, in the vicinity of ICN's dry well. The large quantities of TCE appeared to have contaminated the Troutdale gravel aquifer, a shallow aquifer which is separated by a clay confining layer from the Troutdale sandstone aquifer, which happens to be the aquifer from which the city of Portland derives its backup water supply to the Bull Run Reservoir. ICN did not use any TCE or any of its breakdown products in any appreciable quantities during the course of its operations. It was also apparent that ICN's predecessor, United Medical Laboratories, had no use for any appreciable quantities of TCE in its operations. It was further apparent that Drum Recovery likely dumped large quantities of TCE from their site across the street down ICN's dry well after the lab was closed. So far, ICN has expended in excess of $2 million on remedial investigations, engineering costs, and other expenses as a prelude to remediating the groundwater contamination. At this time, our least cost groundwater cleanup alternative will cost us approximately $3 million more. If the remediation alternative we select is unavailing, then it is possible that our cleanup expenses might be as great as $10 million in addition to what we have already spent. Upon discovering the dry well contamination problem, we called our insurers together for a meeting in Portland. We called them together at that time because we believe that the acts of vandalism by DRI at the dry well contaminated the groundwater and were within the scope of our coverage. Although many of our insurers had excluded pollution, the exclusions were qualified in that they still covered pollution if the release was sudden and accidental. These were occurrence-based policies, which meant that we had coverage provided we could show that a release occurred during the relevant policy periods. We have distributed a workbook for you, which you've probably begun to look at, and at tab 5, we have distributed an abbreviated form of a coverage page, which is representative of the many coverages which were contained in our policies. And you'll note on that coverage page that under exclusions, that there is an exclusion for environmental, but at the bottom, most of the exclusions read, quote, "But this exclusion does not apply if such discharge, dispersal, release, or escape is sudden and accidental." Well, upon convening in Portland, representatives of the insurers met with our engineers, reviewed documents, and were asked by us to form a committee to advise us on ways to keep our costs down while we fulfilled our responsibilities with the Department of Environmental Quality. No insurer volunteered to participate. Each insurer issued denial letters. We have attached a copy of such a preliminary denial letter at tab 6 for your information, and you'll note that a standard denial letter goes numerous pages and contains many, many reasons why the insurer believes that no coverage should be provided. Well, after giving the insurers an opportunity to participate and at minimum advise us on how we could keep costs down, and after the insurers declined to do so, we filed an action in the Multnomah County Circuit Court against approximately 15 insurers. We have since that time settled all of our claims in principle against all of those who issued primary policies. The insurers, however, during the course of the litigation, asserted numerous defenses. And we have appended for your information at tab 7 of our materials an example of the affirmative defenses and the particular ones asserted by Commercial Union Insurance Company. These are representative of the defenses we were required to rebut during the course of litigation. You will note that Commercial Union asserted 51 affirmative defenses to our lawsuit. These defenses were commonly asserted by the other insurers involved. Many of the 51 affirmative defenses directly pertain, in my view, to terms of the policy, and, you know, as a lawyer, I felt they were fair game for discussion, notwithstanding the fact that I vehemently disagreed with them. However, many of the defenses were nothing more, in my opinion, than an attempt to avoid coverage where pollution coverage was already present. The methods which the insurance companies in our case chose to avoid coverage did not, in my view, further Oregon's public policy. When it became apparent that we had settled the majority of our claims, we had occasion to compare notes with those from other Portland law firms who had similar experiences in attempting to obtain coverage from insurance companies for their business clients' environmental remediation obligations. Several of the defenses which were asserted in our case and are commonly asserted in other cases to which this bill pertains were as follows. First, the insurers uniformly argued that the laws of other states should apply, not the state of Oregon. Secondly, the insurers uniformly refused to defend on the grounds that there was no suit. And third, the insurers claimed that by working cooperatively with the DEQ, ICN had made voluntary payments to the DEQ, thereby depriving itself of coverage. A complete copy of Senate Bill 1205A appears at tab 2 of your materials. At tab 3 of your materials, we have followed with our section-by-section detailed analysis of the bill, 1205A. Without getting into the minutia, it is important to recognize, first of all, that this bill does not purport to change policy terms. It does not alter contracts made between insurers and insureds. Rather, it provides for rules of construction for application by Oregon courts when the policies themselves are not clear or where the court finds that the parties to the insurance contract lacked an understanding concerning the meaning of various policy terms. For instance, if an insurance policy is clear that the company has no duty to defend unless an action is filed in a trial court, then this bill will not control the interpretation of the term suits in that policy. It is only where the policy terms are ambiguous or where they are unstated that the provisions of this bill will apply. In particular, Section 4, subsection 2A of the bill provides that unless the policy provides otherwise, the issues of interpretation and enforcement of insurance policies with respect to coverage for environmental cleanup costs shall be governed by Oregon law to the extent that the contaminated property is located in Oregon. The law of other states may not promote cleanup of contaminated property the way Oregon law does. Insofar as the health and safety of Oregonians is paramount, and insofar as the law imposes significant obligations upon property owners to facilitate cleanup, it makes sense that Oregon law should dictate the availability of resources to protect its citizens and to assist the business community. Subsection 2B provides that unless the parties intended otherwise, suit, that word, includes voluntary agreements and responses to agency orders. The manner in which government enforces environmental laws against persons responsible for environmental contamination presents a special situation regarding insurance. Property owners, as you know, can substantially minimize their liability for cleanup and related costs with a proactive approach to the problem. It is common that many cleanups conducted by government are more expensive than cleanups conducted by the property owner. It may therefore be in everyone's best interest to enter into a voluntary agreement with the DEQ. To do so will not only reduce the cost to the owner, but may also allow for more prompt cleanups because the DEQ is not required to commence formal enforcement proceedings against the owner prior to cleanup. Many insurers, however, refuse to pay for the costs an owner incurs when negotiating with the DEQ under the voluntary cleanup program or for the cost of investigating the property at the direction of the DEQ because the DEQ has not filed a formal lawsuit in a court. If an owner cannot afford the cost of site investigation and believes that he or she has pollution coverage, the owner may have to refuse to clean up the property and may have to wait to be sued by the DEQ in order to obtain coverage for these costs. As a result, the threat to health and safety remains unaddressed and the DEQ's resources are needlessly wasted in unnecessary litigation. The DEQ may also pursue treble damages against the owner under those circumstances. This change Section 2B recognizes the rule in Oregon's McCormick and Baxter case and extends it to the voluntary cleanup agreement situation. The rule in McCormick and Baxter also already recognizes responses to agency orders. Subsection 2C relates to voluntary payments. Many insurers attempt to avoid pollution coverage, which is otherwise present, merely because the owner of contaminated property has acted responsibly and has negotiated a voluntary cleanup agreement with the DEQ. In these instances, insurers have taken the position that the insured has voluntarily paid for cleanup and consequently refused to cover the cleanup costs. Such defenses were asserted in our case. However, state and federal cleanup laws impose strict liability upon all persons responsible for cleaning up contaminated property. An owner, therefore, is almost always legally obligated to pay cleanup costs, and it is the owner's election whether to pay less under a voluntary cleanup agreement or substantially more if DEQ is forced to clean up the property first and seek reimbursement from the owner. This section adopts the decisions of several Oregon trial courts and the Washington Supreme Court. There is currently no appellate rule in Oregon which addresses this point. Well, altogether, these positions taken by the insurers discourage voluntary compliance, encourage regulatory disobedience, and are, in my view, awful public policy. The original bill contained many sections which were deleted by the Senate Judiciary Committee and about which you may have heard. The deletion of these additional sections took place following hours of negotiations between the insurance industry and the proponents of Senate Bill 1205. They represented, in my view, a good faith effort on both sides to attempt to address concerns of all parties to this debate. The deleted sections related to prejudice, pre-tender and post-tender costs, exhaustion of primary coverage limits, owned property, and allocation where judgments were rendered in favor of an insured against two or more insurers. By deleting those sections, the committee did not take a position, the Senate Judiciary Committee did not take a position on what the law should be in Oregon. Rather, as Senator Bryant made clear on the floor of the Senate, it was the committee's view that these were matters that should properly be decided by Oregon courts applying Oregon law after the benefit of briefing by policyholders and insurance companies alike. Now, many of you have heard arguments against Senate Bill 1205, primarily the original Senate Bill 1205, from various sources. And because this bill has substantially changed from its original version, I would like to take just a moment to address those arguments. First, some have argued that Senate Bill 1205 changes policy terms. In my view, Senate Bill 1205 does not. It does not apply if a judge makes a finding that the application of the rules in the bill would result in an interpretation contrary to the intent of the parties to a general liability insurance policy. Insurers who drafted the insurance policy are in a much better position to know what is in the fine print than the policyholders. It is our view that ambiguous language should therefore be construed against the drafter. Second, some have argued that the insurance industry could never have appreciated the environmental risks and therefore failed to collect enough premium for certain policies. However, this bill covers all risk policies that covered any peril that was not excluded. That's the way these policies were written. They were written to cover all risks unless particular exclusions apply. Now, to rebut the claim that the insurance was never intended to cover pollution liability, we have appended at tab 8 of your materials portions of an article from the Insurance Council Journal of July 1944 concerning what was then the new 1944 comprehensive general liability policy utilized uniformly by CGL carriers nationwide. If you turn to the second page of that exhibit, you will find that the article states, quote, "The objective has been to afford protection against liability for any hazard not excluded. The plan reverses the old procedure. Instead of insuring against only hazards enumerated, the insurance is broad enough to embrace all exposures to liability loss, except those specifically stated as not covered. Coverage B, property damage liability, which is also a part of the standard CGL policy, requires that an insurer pay on behalf of the insured, quote, all sums which the insured shall become obligated to pay by reason of the liability imposed upon him by law, unquote. Now, finally, this journal, as early as 1944, finally says, quote, summing up, it can readily be seen that except for the limitations established by the standard insuring clauses and exclusions, All hazards of liability loss are covered, whether such hazards are shown to exist or not. The insurance is no longer limited to only those specified hazards against which an insured might ask for protection. Members of the committee, it is therefore readily apparent that my client and many others in the business community purchased all risk policies with the expectation that they would provide insurance for just that, all risks, unless the risks were specifically excluded. Now, some have argued, nevertheless, that no one could have anticipated pollution as a risk, even though all risks other than those excluded are covered, and that it is unfair for this bill to relate to policies for which premium is no longer being collected. At tab 9, you will find a speech made by Mr. Gilbert Bean. Mr. Gilbert Bean is the author of the 1966 revisions to the standard form CGL policy. This is the standard form used by all primary general liability carriers. The 1966 standard form used by all primary liability insurers was amended by Mr. Bean's revisions. Mr. Bean, in his speech to the Mutual Insurance Technical Conference joint meeting, stated at page 21 of that exhibit, quote, "But the most widespread new hazard for manufacturers comes from writing the new policy on an occurrence basis. The operations of some risks may create a substantial gradual injury or gradual property damage exposure to which the insurance did not previously apply. Examples are industries which make serious noise, odor, vibration, or dust. There are also risks," Mr. Bean goes on to say, "which use poisons or toxic or radioactive substances whose operations might create severe hazards to other than employees." On the next page, he goes on to say, quote, "Perhaps it is in the waste disposal area that a manufacturer's basic premises operations coverage is liberalized most substantially. Smoke, fumes, and other air or stream pollution have caused an endless chain of severe claims for gradual property damage." Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Bean made absolutely clear as early as 1965 that insurers knew that the 1966 CGL revisions contemplated coverage for pollution liability, which would be spread gradually over many policy periods. In addition, by writing these policies on an occurrence basis instead of on a claims-made basis, the companies knew their exposures would continue beyond the time premiums were no longer collected anyway. You may have heard the claim that future premiums will rise if this bill is enacted. First, the insurers who would be covered by this bill have all reinsured their risks through worldwide reinsurance companies for these exposures. We have appended, just by way of example, at tab 10 of your materials, the best insurance report for one company, Country Companies. This report is quite common among the other insurers. You'll note at what is designated at page 1387 of that exhibit, an indication that with respect to reinsurance programs, the largest amount which Country Companies is now exposed in any one of these risks is $600,000. The report here says, casualty excess of loss reinsurance affords protection against bodily injury or property damage liability losses exceeding $600,000 up to $6.6 million on an occurrence basis. Therefore, this particular company is reinsured for between $600,000 and $6.6 million on each and every claim to which its reinsurance applies. And finally, the state of Washington, whose case law, statutory law, but whose case law reflects many of the original terms that were contained in Senate Bill 1205 and which have been since deleted, has not experienced any notable premium insurance increase for these types of policies within the last 5 years. And that is because these premiums are more a factor of supply and demand than they are anything else. And we have interviewed some of the folks in the Washington Insurance Commissioner's Office, and they have made it very clear that these premiums have not varied at all substantially within the last 5 years. Mr. Chairman, we have appended at tab 11 a proposed amendment for your consideration, and we included the working draft when we prepared these materials. What is it? Tab 11 now corresponds to the A10 amendments which you have currently before you. The proposed amendment pertains to page 1, line 24 of the A engrossed version of the bill. and frankly, it corrects a drafting oversight and does not vary at all with the intention embraced within this bill. In order to avail oneself of the benefits of Senate Bill 1205, a person must be an insured, as that term of art is defined. Section 2.3 of the bill defines an insured as a person who is a named insured on a general liability insurance policy and who has a property interest in a site in Oregon that involves an environmental claim. We are suggesting that the words "or had" be added to also cover persons who may no longer have a present property interest in a contaminated site, but who in the past had such an interest when the release occurred. By adopting this amendment, you will permit those persons who are pursued by the DEQ by virtue of their position in the chain of title to enter into voluntary cleanup agreements without fear of being denied their coverage. In addition, you will permit those who presently have property interests in a contaminated site to have more flexibility in structuring prospective purchaser agreements under Oregon's prospective purchaser law. Under that law, the DEQ can release a new purchaser, a prospective purchaser, from liability for cleanup if the DEQ feels that the current owner will, in fact, accomplish the cleanup and where the new purchaser will devote the property to beneficial use. Your adoption of this amendment will encourage transfer of what are called brownfields to prospective purchasers under the prospective purchaser law. Otherwise, an insured would not want to divest himself of a present property interest for fear of losing the benefits that Senate Bill 1205 allow. Mr. Chairman, thank you for wading through all this with me. I realize it has been lengthy. In conclusion, I want to thank you for your patience and attention during this presentation. I believe Senate Bill 1205A is a significant bill which will greatly assist in furthering Oregon's policy towards cleaning up its hazardous waste sites and will further be of assistance to businesses which merely seek to do the right thing. There are farmers, gas station owners, dry cleaners, owners of property which in the past were polluted by business activities which were at the time illegal. There are also those such as ICN who were the victims of vandalism. We are not polluters. We were the victims of vandalism. The insurance, remember, does not apply unless the release was sudden and accidental. So we're not attempting to give a benefit to a person who purposely polluted. We are providing a benefit to a person who can otherwise qualify under their insurance coverage, likely a person who suffered an accident. All of these concerns face strict liability for cleanup, nevertheless. Some of them are fortunate enough to have pre-1986 CGL policies, which cover pollution if the release was sudden and accidental. Why should these concerns be encouraged to thumb their nose at the regulators and refuse to cooperate for fear of losing their insurance coverage? A DEQ administrative order is just as coercive as a lawsuit. Insurers should not be permitted to avoid otherwise valid claims just because the insured seeks to do the right thing. I urge the committee to approve Senate Bill 1205A to assist our business community in honoring its cleanup obligations and to not prejudice companies which are trying to be good corporate citizens. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I'm available to respond to any questions if there are any.
Thank you. It's a good overview. Questions of the committee? Mr. Burns? He's up there to proofread. Okay. All right.
Thank
Hang
you.
Around. We'll bring up some other witnesses here. John Powell, do you want to come on up? I think we had the introduction to the Dash 10 amendments. I understand you're going to introduce us to the Dash 12 amendments. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing CGU, North Pacific, and State Farm Insurance Companies. While I am tempted to debate all of the issues that you just heard, I will refrain and subdue myself, since I can hardly stand to talk about these issues, since we've spent so much time, as Mr. DiLorenzo pointed out, on the Senate side. So let it suffice to say that we disagree on many of the points that were presented to you. 1944, I was 3 years from conception. In 1966, I was a senior in high school. In both periods, there was no DEQ and there was no EPA. Times changed very rapidly with chemicals and pollution. And I think one of the basic disagreements over the original bill that was introduced is that your comprehensive general liability policy is purchased to defend you against lawsuits. The reason there are so many defenses in that is that you want those defenses used when somebody is bringing an action against you. And this bill did, in fact, go back, and it would have, in fact, applied to people who allowed their own land to be polluted, which since those years of 1944 and 1966, policy in this country has been not to reward polluters, but to punish polluters and to require them to clean up their property. Having said that, the A-12 amendments address one section of Senate Bill 1205 that was the subject of a lot of discussion on the Senate side, and we could not come to a conclusion. And that is a provision that deals with attorney fees. And if you'll look at the bill on page 2, lines 37 through 42, it deals with when an offer would have to be tendered to avoid attorney fees. And we dealt with a 60-day period prior to the trial. Mr. DiLorenzo had talked about a 9-month period prior to the trial. The chair of the committee adopted this particular provision based on a provision he was working on in the condemnation laws. The problem that we ran into with all of these provisions is that in these cases, as Mr. DiLorenzo pointed out, there are usually multiple defendants. In his case, there were 15 different parties at the table. When those tenders are made and for how much and which part of the settlement or the judgment they apply to, it's extremely confusing. So in talking to the chairman on the Senate side, we could not come to a better resolution. It was then discovered that Section 5 in the printed bill before you is defective in the way it would operate and didn't meet the original meaning of that bill. And so we've basically agreed to delete that section and allow the current attorney fees provision to govern and basically let the court decide the operation of this section.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, when you say, John, when you say the current provision of attorney fees, what are you talking about? Are you talking a statutory contract?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bubalo, that is correct, the current statutory scheme for attorney fees. So that's basically where we're at. This amendment would allow at least my clients to not be supportive of the bill, but to basically back off.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Powell?
I want to follow through on that. When you talked about the statutory attorney's fees, what particular statute are you referring
to? The same one referred to in the bill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, he's deleting that, though. He's deleting down through page through 42.
You wanted to respond to that, John?
He's taking out 37 through 42, and 42, line 42, talks about being allocated pursuant to 742060. He's taking that out, but you're still saying that would still apply.
It would still govern.
In taking it out, you are not saying nothing applies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Overlight, you are correct. That statute would still apply.
Okay, because it's not clear. Because
Mr. Chairman, Representative Overlight, the only reason that's in the bill is it allowed for an election, basically.
Okay.
Thank you for pointing that out.
So Chairman, by deleting that, you're into that scheme without any election. It's automatic.
Correct.
Yeah, that was my understanding
yes.
of the amendment. Representative Lowe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Powell?
Hello.
Hi. ICN has acquiesced in the deletion of Section 5 as well as Lana and Grace and the rest of them.
The amendments that Mr. DiLorenzo
pointed
out? Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have next Angela Warren and Ann O'Neill, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Angela Warren. I represent the American Insurance Association. We're a national organization that has over 375 members, many of whom write insurance here in Oregon. In fact, we represent 62% of the liability market, and for that reason have a huge stake in this legislation. I have with me today Ann Neal O'Neill, who's with Fireman's Fund. She's in the General Counsel's office. She has practiced environmental litigation for 15 years and has vast experience in many other states, as well as Oregon. First, I'd like to commend the Oregon legislature for the substantial improvement made on SB 1205 since it was introduced. However, we still have some problems with it. I'm just going to touch lightly on one of the problems, and then Ann is going to continue on with further comments. One of the problems we have, and I have to disagree with Mr. DeLorenzo, is that when he's saying that that he's not attempting to rewrite insurance contracts, but if you're talking about developing rules of construction, that's exactly what you're doing. You're taking on a new and different interpretation of the language that's in the contract, and that's problematic because our companies have come to rely and policyholders have come to rely on the language that's in those contracts. And what we think is that we may have a situation here where we're going to end up defaulting to the courts in order to get a constitutional clarification of the impact of SB 1205. Now I'll go ahead and pass my time to Ann.
I'd like to ask a question.
Representative Ubelau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you raised a point that also was raised in a letter that I received, and when I received it, I went back and reviewed the bill several times because I cannot see how the bill does this. And actually, in that letter, says the same thing you did. The bill creates coverage when none exists and for which no premium was ever collected. And basically, that's what you were saying too, that it's, the bill gives coverage where coverage didn't exist before. Can you point to me the specific language in the bill you think does that?
I think that that letter may have been written on the basis of an earlier version when it was addressing the suit language. And I could tell you that one of the perspectives our companies have had is that when you're taking suit and expanding it to administrative proceedings, voluntary agreements that we've talked about, that that is not the risk that was contemplated when the insurer and the policyholder entered into the insurance contract. For that reason, we felt that we'd be open up to unlimited and endless defense costs that we didn't anticipate at the beginning. And that's what I mean by expanding the language that's in the insurance contract.
Follow up.
Thank you. So you're not talking about expanding the coverage per se. You're talking about expanding where you have to defend.
Well, right, but that in essence is also expanding the coverage.
Further questions? Ms. O'Neill.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to appear before you today. As Angela mentioned, I'm in the General Counsel's Office, the Fireman's Fund Insurance Company, and I've practiced environmental coverage law for many years. I'm sent here by Fireman's Fund to talk to you about something, an issue that I don't believe has been raised yet, and that Fireman's Fund would like to have you carefully consider. Our company's done business with thousands upon thousands of Oregon citizens over the past 150 years. And it's very, very proud of having met the commercial and personal needs of its Oregon customers over this very long history. I've been asked to appear before your committee today to ask you to carefully consider the precedential impact of Senate Bill 1205. In its present form, this bill goes further than any insurance law in any other state in the nation by taking the task of private contract interpretation away from the courts where we believe it belongs, and placing it into a new forum, the legislature. We believe contract interpretation belongs in the courts and should stay in the courts. This is because insurance is a business founded on two concepts. One of those is the ability to calculate risk. The other is the legal interpretation of its contracts. Both demand for us to do business profitably and comfortably and to meet our business clients' needs an expectation of predictability. Insurers need to know that a contract written today will not be arbitrarily rewritten tomorrow. Insurers cannot do business successfully in this kind of environment. Today, this bill has asserted an environmental emergency. and the bill takes the contract interpretation task away from the courts on the basis of this emergency. Insurers are concerned and ask themselves, well, next year will there be another kind of emergency on another kind of policy for another kind of loss? How can we be sure? Those of you who are business people should ask yourselves whether you would be able to continue to do business in an environment where your contracts ran the risk of being arbitrarily rewritten by a legislative body, where you don't have the opportunity to appear in court and to argue the facts and the circumstances that are presented in the interpretation of that policy, and where the judicial function is not a part of the process. I've been asked to bring the message to you that it would be very difficult to continue to write affordable insurance in a state where the insurance laws were created on the basis of today's presumed needs without regard for tomorrow's costs. This bill might satisfy the needs of a minority of Oregon business owners who face very realistic long-term environmental exposures, but it holds the potential for hurting a far greater number of Oregon businesses if its net result is to cause insurers to restrict coverage. This bill would not make it any easier for insurers and their insureds to settle claims, and it would do nothing to avoid coverage litigation or to promote mediation between insurers and their customers. Our concern with the bill, though less so now in its present form, and it is a very big concern, is that the bill was entirely one-sided. It appeared to be all take, no give. It failed to recognize the mutual rights and obligations of contracting parties. The bill, unfortunately, appeared to assume bad motives, and we understand that there have been problems. I think the insurance industry will acknowledge that there have been problems. But the problems are not universal, and some of the positions that the carriers have taken, that most carriers have taken in most circumstances, have been based on their own belief in a reasonable interpretation of the contract. I come to you today and tell you that if Oregon passes a law through its courts, through the judicial system, which evaluates the interpretation of those contracts in the way that we're used to, logically and obviously we will follow those laws. We do in every state in the nation. The bill, though, in its original form, and again less so today, assumed bad motives on the parts of carriers, and it failed to recognize that insurers and their insureds need to be cooperative business partners. Oregon law is sophisticated. Oregon contract law I am familiar with. Oregon's judges and courts are among the best in the nation. Oregon's courts and juries can recognize and do, as necessary, punish insurers who practice in a bad faith manner in the enforcement of their contracts. We believe that this legislature should trust Oregon's courts and Oregon's juries and have confidence in their decisions and their ability to do what they traditionally have been asked to do. The precedent set by this bill would not change a narrow area of coverage law. It would alter an entire system of interpreting the civil law. It's a bad precedent, and we hope you avoid it. I'd like to make two very brief comments. One is on the basis of a comment that Mr. DiLorenzo made regarding insurance premium. He said that in Washington, insurance premiums for this kind of insurance have not increased appreciably in the past 5 years. The kind of insurance that Mr. DiLorenzo is talking about has not been written in most states in this country since 1985. Carriers put absolute pollution exclusions on most of their policies, and certainly their commercial general liability policies, in 1985, and most of the courts in this country have been uniform in enforcing those provisions in environmental coverage cases. However, to meet their business policyholder needs, many companies in the past several years have started to open up a new market. They've started to actually write environmental insurance again. And the reason that they're able to do that is because there's more predictability in the enforcement of environmental laws, and because carriers realize that their business customers need this kind of insurance. But I've been asked to bring you the message that it's not going to be easy or at all palatable to write this kind of insurance where carriers need to be afraid that next year someone's going to say, well, wait a minute, now we need to interpret this in a way that negates the limitations on this kind of insurance. Carriers know the courts, they trust the courts, they do not always agree with the court's decisions, they do not always like the court's decisions, but I think that all of you know in your own experience that as a very general rule, carriers do follow the court's decisions, and when they don't, they have been given punishment by the court in the form of punitive damages. And that possibility and that remedy exists in Oregon. Thank you.
Representative Webelo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what you just said about in the past having absolute pollution exclusions and now starting to write some environmental insurance, when Mr. DiLorenzo testified, he testified that in many of the policies that he was dealing with, they had exclusions except they were qualified and they would cover it if the release was sudden and accidental.
Yes.
So my question of you is, when you talked about in the past absolute pollution exclusion, are you saying even if it wasn't sudden and accidental, or do you agree with Mr. DiLorenzo?
No. Mr. DiLorenzo is correct in that starting in about 1973 in most states, carriers included in their policies what's called a limited pollution exclusion or sometimes called the sudden and accidental pollution exclusion. This pollution exclusion excludes all coverage for gradual pollution, that's the intent, and makes an exception if the pollution arose because of a sudden and accidental release of contaminants. Because of the enormous increase in environmental exposures in 1985, many carriers, in order to be able to continue to write commercial liability insurance, added what's called an absolute pollution exclusion. They're very uniform. The wording was approved by the Insurance Services Offices, ISO. That exclusion is still on many policies, but today, which was not the case for a very long time, business owners who need limited pollution coverage can actually purchase that coverage in the market. It has become available in many, many places. I'm not an expert on that kind of insurance, but I do know it's a product that has become more available than ever before since 1985.
Yes, sure.
You made that, you had that discussion in terms of Mr. DiLorenzo's statement that premiums had not increased in Washington in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, how do we know which type of policies that he was referring to? I mean, you made a statement.
That was my question, too. I didn't know what kinds of policies he was referring to, but I know that in the past 5 years, policies with sudden and accidental pollution exclusions probably have not been sold in the state of Washington. I certainly don't know of any other market for that kind of insurance right now.
But the ones with occurrence, so you're saying they're not even writing in with sudden and accidental.
No. But sudden and accidental.
Until recently.
That's right. That's right. I didn't mean to imply that there was a choice. After 1985, it became almost impossible to get it.
I guess the gist of your testimony that I hear is that you would rather have the courts construe these as contract terms than have the legislature weigh in.
Yes, that's right.
But the insurance industry is already so heavily regulated, both in terms of statute and administrative rule. Why should we refrain when we're presented? Is it
basically
what this bill does? Is that your real objection more than that you're playing in the game?
Yes and no. Frankly, we don't like the bill. I can't pretend that I do. But we are concerned. We believe that the other carriers in the AIA have spoke to you at great length about the problems with the bill as it was originally written and as we see it today. And we appreciate all their comments. This was another issue that we saw. We do not want to take the interpretation of contracts out of the courts. Part of the problem, part of what you have just said about insurance regulations, of course, is entirely accurate, and I don't think there's a carrier in the country that would for a minute suggest that the legislature does not have the power and ability and the right to make insurance regulations. And they regulate the actual business of insurance. For those of you who are familiar with what the state of Washington did in its Claims Handling Practices Act, Washington's law, which all carriers didn't agree with at the time, was eventually refined into a Claims Handling Practices Act. Washington's law, for the most part, does not purport to interpret individual insurance contracts. This legislation goes beyond the rules set by Washington, and frankly, I'm not aware of any state that actually legislates the interpretation of contract wording. And it is a very frightening thought for carriers who don't believe that they'll be able to write contracts and have them interpreted in the courts. Legislative interpretation is a much more abrupt process and much more far-reaching.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Loeb.
We have had indication from other people in the industry that they have been a party to the negotiations in this concerning this bill and were a party to compromises that were proposed in Amendments 10 and 12. Were you a party to those?
No, I haven't been a party to any of the prior negotiations.
Okay.
I am concerned about one matter, if you'll grant me a moment to mention it. The one concern I have, the primary concern I have about the bill in its present form is in Section 4C. And the last line says, shall not be denied the insured on the ground that such expenses constitute voluntary payments by the insured. I understand from listening to Mr. DiLorenzo and from speaking with my colleagues what the intent of that provision is. My concern is that it does not specify that the carriers are not to lose their pretender defenses. The wording in the general liability contracts is that the insured shall not assume payments voluntarily. And this is a very important provision in our contracts because it protects us against collusion. It protects us against some insureds who spend inordinate amounts of money and tender years after they've begun. Sometimes in some states, voluntary payments are certainly payable. But this particular provision creates an ambiguity, and we'd like to ask that it be reconsidered, if not to change the intent of the provision itself, but to clarify that it's not meant to have any impact on pretender law. I understand that was part of one of the earlier versions of the bill, and it was eliminated.
Follow?
Sure.
Okay. And to the other lady sitting at the dais, were you a party to the negotiations that ended up in the compromise amendments?
Yes, in a limited fashion, but I want to point out that one of the reasons why some of the insurers are now neutral on the bill is because the type of business they write is not being implicated. As I was saying before, our members write 62% of the market, so it's very easy for those insurers who, for example, primarily write homeowners and write motor vehicles to get off the bill.
Okay, and follow-up question, if I may.
Sure.
Okay. Regarding the amendment or the section, who's that? 3.2C, regarding the pretender defense and the issue of collision.
4C, I believe.
4C. 4C, thank you. You do agree that it's the province of the legislature to set public policy regarding encouraging people to mitigate environmental damages by cooperating with the DEQ.
Oh, I don't...
Pretender collusion notwithstanding.
No, I don't have any problem with any legislature encouraging people to cooperate.
Thank you.
And, but not in this chair.
Representative, I just want to mention, too, the issue of the voluntary payments. I think that has to be seen in light of the preceding clause there in 4.2c that mm-hmm. does indicate the context in which that, I think voluntary may be almost a misnomer in the context in which this would occur, but this is a voluntary agreement, consent decree, or consent order between the insured and DEQ or the EPA that results written direction, request, or agreement by the DEQ or EPA. So voluntary, but not necessarily voluntary when you've got the regulatory agency coming down, and the choice is either to take action now to remediate while you can do so at this level of cost, or to force them into filing suit and then having to do it under the policy. And I think this was one of the points of the bill, was to enable insureds to obtain the benefit of the coverage through a voluntary or consent decree, that kind of a situation, without having to force this thing into the litigation mode before insurance coverage would kick in.
I understand that purpose of the bill. The concern from the carrier's perspective is in a voluntary payment situation that the carrier be adequately notified and that the claim be tendered to the carrier before the insured incurs these costs without allowing a carrier who intends to defend and who has an obligation to defend to participate in the defense of the litigation and to have some oversight ability with respect to those costs.
Is your concern that this somehow supersedes that by implication? It doesn't expressly.
I don't think the intent is to supersede that, but I think that the use of the term voluntary payments without a clarification can create an ambiguity which is inevitably going to result in a contest. And to the extent you can eliminate coverage contest, I think everybody is better off, carriers and insured, certainly.
Objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I almost hesitate to ask this since so many hours were spent in the Senate on this matter and you wrestled with it. But in looking at 4.2c, I'm reminded of workers' comp law when there's third-party liability. If you're going to settle in that situation, you have to bring the insurer. Sure, all parties have to be involved and agree. And I just wondered, and that's to protect them all, mm-hmm. the workers' comp carrier and so forth. And I'm just wondering, did you have discussions about something along those lines on the Senate side when this was mainly discussed, just about your concerns that you voiced about notice to the insurer and taking part in those discussions with the EQ, between the polluter and the EQ? Was there any discussion about actually putting something in there that would have made you feel more secure, but yet would not interfere with early cleanup?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Warren.
We can't really respond to that because we weren't personally involved in the negotiations. I would assume that conversation did take place.
Also, Mr. Gordon is here, and I believe he's supposed to speak this afternoon, and I believe he was involved in those conversations and could fill you in on that aspect of them.
Okay. Anything else for these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Telfer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Telfer, and I'm representing the Alliance of American Insurers, which is a national trade association with about 300 property and casualty insurer members. I want to make it very clear that we were part of the group that worked on this, and we are very appreciative of the number of amendments that have been made between the original version that was presented in the Senate and today. However, I still need to go on record as being opposed to the bill. In the Alliance's view, this will alter and expand the obligations of insurers under general liability policies, and that, in our opinion, is likely to have a detrimental effect on both the availability and the cost of general liability insurance in Oregon. And the concern, I guess, we have is that the very people that I think the bill is intended to assist may well be in a spot where it's going to be very much more difficult for them to find general liability coverage if they happen to own property or have had property in an area that is likely to have had long-term environmental pollution. I'll leave it at that. I'll be happy to respond to questions, and I might say that we just saw the Dash A-12 amendments this afternoon, and I think we would be very supportive of those.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, in your written comments here, you say because insurers may be exposed to wide open and uncontrollable expenses for the voluntary cleanup, which really leads to the question I asked the two women who spoke before this, and you said you were part of the negotiations. Was there any discussion about language that might make the insurance company feel more comfortable when there's discussions about voluntary or general consent or cleanup type of thing? You were at the table, so to speak, to know what was going on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uberlau, I was not directly at the table. I think that we probably would have to rely on Tom Gordon or perhaps John Powell to get to the answer to your question. I understand it. Sorry, I can't respond.
Okay.
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Telfer. You mentioned that you liked the A-12s. What happened, Tom? Sorry. You liked the A-12s and amendments, correct? With the addition of the A-12s, are you then in support of the bill?
No, I can't be on record in support of the bill. Just on general principles, we think this is bad public policy. But we are supportive of the -12 because we believe the attorney's fee section that's in the bill now is ill-crafted and good.
And that's the part, yeah, okay. So that's kind of like kissing your sister. Huh? Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Tim Bernasek and Terry Witt. Why don't you both come on up together? Welcome back.
Yeah, go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasek. I'm Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 1205. I apologize for not having copies of my testimony to give out to you, but I will try to be very brief. Senate Bill 1205 helps farmers and business owners work with state and federal agencies to clean up contamination on their property in a cooperative manner. Currently, a farmer faces a dilemma if environmental contamination is found on his property. He can work cooperatively with the agencies to get the site cleaned up and face a loss of any insurance coverage, or he can wait for DEQ to file a lawsuit against him under the state's environmental laws. However, DEQ can choose not to file a lawsuit and can instead clean up the site and charge up to 3 times the cost of cleanup to the farmer for not cooperating cleaning up the site. This dilemma is particularly troubling if the contamination occurred decades ago as a result of third-party vandalism, a situation that is covered in many pre-1986 general liability policies. In these situations, the farmer thought he was covered for such claims and now must deal not only with DEQ and EPA, but also faces filing a lawsuit against his insurer to provide the coverage that they were obligated to provide. Senate Bill 1205 deals with this dilemma in a fair manner. It does not rewrite any insurance policies, but instead provides rules of construction to be applied when the language of a policy is not clear. I won't go through all the details. You've heard over and over again the three main areas that are left. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, environmental cleanup is a costly business with costs easily running into the several $1 million range. Most, if not all, general liability insurance policies currently written provide express pollution exclusions. And where this exclusion is expressly stated, it is not only fair for the insured to face the risk of cleanup without coverage. However, those farmers and business people who purchased insurance reasonably believing pollution releases were covered in their policies should be protected. I think it's reasonable to assume that when decades ago you bought an all-risk policy, all-risk policies to farmers and small business people, it would seem fair to cover all risks. Since the insurance companies are the ones who drafted these policies, they're the ones who should face the risks associated with such ambiguous language. I think one fundamental tenet of contract law, if I remember not so many years ago being in first-year contracts, is that any ambiguities are drafted or are construed against the drafter. And I think that that's an issue, I think, really is at the nub of this whole issue. Certainly, I think it's fair to say that members of the insurance industry maybe weren't aware of some of the upcoming changes in the law dealing in the environmental area. But I'd say the same thing's true of farmers and small business people that purchase these policies as well. And I go back again that when it's presented around the table in the kitchen after hours, when the insurance salesman comes and says you're going to be covered for all risks and a pollution policy under this general liability policy, I think it's reasonable to assume for that farmer, rancher, or small business person that really means all risks for pollution coverage. And again, Farm Bureau supports 1205 and respectfully urges you to support it as well, and be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the bill.
Okay. Mr. Witt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I will not read my testimony, which is before you, but just bring out a couple points. Most of the members of Oregonians for Food and Shelter are either farmers, foresters, commercial applicators, or those who handle agricultural chemicals, which includes, excuse me, pesticides, fertilizers, and soil amendments. By classification, these are all considered hazardous materials and do require extensive cleanup should contamination occur. As a result of that, I think many of our farmers and small businesses across the state had purchased insurance years ago, as was stated before, thinking that what they were buying was all-risk insurance to cover for catastrophic liability in these kind of instances. They didn't buy the insurance for minor problems. They bought it to save the farm, literally, should they have a problem. In looking at the bill and the issues involved, we do not believe, Oregonians for Food and Shelter do not believe that this will provide unintended coverage to past policyholders. We do not believe it will create massive unintended liability payouts for the insurance industry, nor do we believe it will be a cause for significant premium skyrocketing or significant change in availability of pollution policies. What we do believe this bill will do is to ensure policyholders that they get what they are entitled to receive and what they have paid premiums for, and will encourage a more timely and cost-efficient cleanup of identified contamination sites in Oregon through voluntary action. And I think that's a worthy goal that we are all supportive of. I view Senate Bill 1205 as, in essence, a truth in environmental insurance law. It basically states that the insurer will get what he or she pays for, and not wait till a point in time in history when they go to make claim against that policy to find out through legal maneuvering and extensive legal battles with corporate lawyers that they have no coverage, or to obtain that coverage they have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fights to potentially recoup some of that money. The OFS Board of Directors voted unanimously to support Senate Bill 1205. We ask that you act favorably on it. And I guess I would like to close with one comment to the insurance industry, and that is that when they talk about this bill will create the exclusion or the industry to potentially stop writing this kind of policy, I guess my question is, what good is a policy that pretends to cover but doesn't? I think if I were a policy holder, I would much rather have the exclusion written in plain black and white English saying that I am not covered for this than to believe that I was until I needed it and then be told, sorry, but you're out of luck. So if they're going to exclude it, they ought to do it in black and white. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Witt? Okay. I want to ask John DiLorenzo to come up and clarify the record on a point I think that Ms. Warren and Ms. O'Neill raised. Like you, I can't help but make a passing comment on a letter that's been distributed to us from Paul Brown from American International Group New York, in New York, and I'll that explains it. His last sentence at the bottom of the page, referring to insurance contract provisions like any others, were previously agreed upon through arm's-length negotiations between insurer and insured. I'd like a show of hands of the last person that negotiated a contract, an insurance contract. Oh, okay, no hands are going up. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I will keep my comments very brief. I just wanted to mention three points that were raised. First of all, there was some question as to what the relevance was of premiums, general premiums increases, or lack of them, on general CGL policies in Washington. The reason we did that research and noted that general CGL policies have not gone up within the last 5 years was because early on in our debate over Senate Bill 1205, one of the insurers raised the specter of huge price increases for general CGL policies to cover losses that insurers might incur in other arenas. Because the state of Washington, in addition to its regulatory scheme, also has case law on the appellate level that was very similar to many of the provisions of the original Senate Bill 1205, which have since been omitted, we thought it would be interesting to inquire as to whether that, in fact, occurred. And, in fact, there were no such cost increases for general CGL policies in the state of Washington during that time frame, notwithstanding the fact that the state of Washington had, through case law, adopted many of the provisions that we had in the original Senate Bill 1205. So that was the relevance of that particular issue. But then several other insurers came back and said, if Senate Bill 1205 is passed, this will discourage us from placing new products on the market. In other words, the new pollution coverage, which you must buy separately, because today all of your CGL policies have absolute pollution exclusions. And we addressed a letter back to one of the carriers and said, but Senate Bill 1205 doesn't apply if the language is precise. It doesn't apply if a court rules that the parties, that these interpretive aids would differ from the intention of the parties. And because these are yet-to-be marketed products, brand-new products, our suggestion to the insurers was that when you introduce the new product, write it clearly. Exclude what you truly mean to exclude. Then you can write around Senate Bill 1205. We had no response to that letter, which was in response to that second argument. The third argument I just wanted to briefly address had to do with the issue which was raised by counsel for Farmers Fund regarding the provisions on voluntary payments. And I'd like to say that the original bill, 1205, addressed pretender in a number of areas. In the original version, it addressed notice in Section 4.2d. It addressed timely notice and what was timely and what was prejudiced and what would be qualified as prejudice in Section 4.2e. It addressed when pretender costs and expenses would be covered in Section 4.2f. Those provisions have since been eliminated in this bill. These affirmative defenses that insurers raise in insurance coverage litigation all stack on top of one another, and that is because there is a variety of exclusions. Voluntary payments is one particular exclusion. Certainly notice is a matter that pertains to other exclusions. If you could very quickly just take a look at our tab 7, which was the answer of Commercial Union, take a look at affirmative defense number 47. It is on page
7.
There are many affirmative defenses.
47?
I'm sorry. Paragraph
47.
Paragraph 47, the 12th affirmative defense. That defense was Commercial Union is not liable for costs incurred by ICN prior to the tender to Commercial Union of matters described in the amended complaint. That, I think, is the affirmative defense and an exclusion which would no longer be affected by this bill. Compare that to paragraph 57.
57.
Which is 57, which is on page 11, which was the 21st affirmative defense. And it said Commercial Union is not liable for monetary obligations assumed or monies voluntarily paid by ICN in addressing the alleged contamination described in the amended complaint. That particular affirmative defense would be affected by this bill. Interestingly, though, if you could compare that to paragraph 67, which is on page 13, after making that affirmative defense, Commercial Union also said that ICN's claims were barred and or reduced because we failed to act reasonably on our own behalf to minimize, avoid, or otherwise mitigate damages. So on the one hand, we're not allowed to make voluntary payments to the DEQ in the course of a voluntary cleanup agreement, yet if we don't act fast enough, we have not mitigated our damages. So
question.
The only affirmative defense that would have been affected by this new version of the bill would have been the one that I just reviewed on voluntary payments.
Representative Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. DeLorenzo, what's the present status of this case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, the case has been settled and dismissed officially as to all defendants with the exception of Travelers. Travelers and ICN have negotiated an agreement in principle, and we are currently documenting that. And this case, all parties realize, will be settled. And
so the case is moot, and this this piece of legislation won't affect this case.
This legislation will not affect this case. However, I should, with all candor, make it very clear that if, in the course of our remediation, we end up going beyond our least cost alternative, we do have excess carriers who we may choose to ask to step up to the plate. And of course, any claims we may have against the excess carriers would be affected by this legislation.
Have we heard from any of your excess carriers today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, we originally named all of the excess carriers. And the excess carriers came in several years ago and defended on the grounds that we could not name them until such time as we had exhausted the primary layer of coverage. Judge Lowe, or I'm sorry, not per me. I appear before Judge Lowe quite often. I was just Judge Keyes in Multnomah County ruled that. Pardon me, Judge Keyes ruled.
Thanks, John.
Sorry about that.
Judge
Keyes ruled that the excess carriers would be given a choice. They could stay in and monitor the case if they so chose, or they could ask to be dismissed from the case. They uniformly asked to be dismissed from the case.
Just for the record, then, to clarify the answer that you gave on this issue, the provision in the bill for coverage of payments made pursuant to written voluntary agreements, consent decrees, and consent orders doesn't otherwise abrogate whatever obligation a policy holder may have to provide notice to the insurance company of any pending settlement or claim.
Mr. Chairman, I read the bill the way you have stated it.
Okay, and to clarify the record, because we are on the Internet, nobody I'm related has had anything to do with this case. Is that correct, Mr. DiLorenzo?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lowe, that is correct. I apologize.
Thank you.
Judge Lowe has had nothing to do with this matter.
Thank
Representative
you.
Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. DiLorenzo, on Section 422A, where it describes that Oregon laws to be applied where the property is located in Oregon, what if the suit is being brought in a different state, but the property is located in Oregon? Would it still be your reading that this section would require Oregon law to be applied by the courts of a different state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, it all depends on what that state's conflict provisions would be. Certainly, if the case were brought in a federal court, the federal court would have its own conflict provisions. It is very likely that the federal court would apply Oregon law. As to the policy's interpretation concerning that particular property located in the state of Oregon, if other properties were involved, regular common law conflict of laws rules would apply, is my understanding.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Under Section 4, Paragraph 3, you say that the rules of construction, which are set forth in A, B, and C, shall not be applicable if there is an interpretation contrary to, based upon the intent of the parties. Would there be an opportunity, in your opinion, for one of the parties to assert that at the time they entered into this agreement that any one of these sections, A, B, and C, even though it was not expressly discussed or defined in the contract, that based upon prevailing law at that point in time, they could argue that that was clearly the intent of the parties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I am sure insurers would make that argument. However, this provision is designed to encourage an insurance company to write clearly what it means. And there are many who feel that typical customer who purchases insurance would regard EPA or the DEQ requiring cleanup pursuant to an agency order as tantamount to a lawsuit. And unless the policy had clearly defined what that meant, that it would be fair to defer in favor of the policyholder as against the party who wrote the contract. You know, ambiguities, in my view, should be construed against the drafter, and there are very rarely occasions for the parties to negotiate these provisions at all. These are agreements which are presented on a take-it-or-leave-it basis.
Mr. Chairman, so it's your testimony that if the agreement, the contract specifically says that there must be a suit for coverage to be provided, it's expressly stated in the contract. Let's say this is a contract from 30 years ago. It expressly says there must be a lawsuit for coverage to be provided. You're saying that Section 4, Paragraph 3, would not apply in that case, even though that was the clear intent of the parties.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, first of all, in order to discern the intent of the parties, the first thing the court will do is look at the contract. If the contract is clear as can be, then it is likely that clear language in the contract will prevail. The problem here has to do with what does suit mean? And many courts have varied with California's courts and have said that most people who purchased insurance contracts would regard agency action by the DEQ or the EPA as tantamount to a suit. Now, if, for instance, the contract said lawsuits filed in a state court or lawsuits filed in a federal court, yes, then there would be a much clearer case as to what the intent of the parties were. But, you know, let's face it, the court is rarely going to have all the original parties available to hear testimony from, and even if they do hear testimony from them, it is very unlikely that when a purchaser of an insurance contract was negotiating, as Mr. Bernasic said in his example, over a breakfast table at a farmhouse, that the parties had a lengthy discussion concerning any of these provisions. So the court would first look at the contract to see whether it is ambiguous or extremely clear. I'm sorry for the long-winded answer, but follow up.
Sure. Specifically on Section 4, 2B, you have the word request being equivalent to a suit. So if the EPA or the DEQ requests that certain action be taken, that will be interpreted to be tantamount to a suit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, if it is in writing, and that proviso was made, by the way, as a result of our extensive discussions with the insurance industry.
Well, isn't it possible that there might be a request made that there's no intent or plan to take some kind of enforcement action following the request if the request is not complied with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, in my experience, I have never encountered an experience in which an agency has requested that work be done and has not followed up with threats of enforcement action if the work is not done. I have not seen any occasions in which these have just been helpful hints or suggestions. They are commands.
Well, and I think too, if I may, going back to this issue of notice under the policy, I would assume, based on the discussion we had before, that a payment at this point would be made after notice to the insurance company. And so if the insurance company is looking at this and saying, yeah, this is just a, gee, we'd like you to do this, if you don't mind, kind of request, the insurance company is probably going to have something to say about its willingness to participate at that point anyway, if you are at that kind of a request.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. The intent here is the moment that a policyholder receives such a written request, policyholder should immediately send that notification to the insurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gidomanza, do you believe that if this bill passes, that it will increase recovery on insurance claims for these types of actions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I think if this bill passes, it will prevent insurance companies from avoiding otherwise valid claims. To the extent that insurance companies today are successful in avoiding a certain number of claims because parties have decided to cooperate with the DEQ, yes, then of course the necessary implication is that the insurance companies will have to start paying in some instances where they did not before.
If that's the case, how will those costs be? Who will pick up those additional costs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, that was precisely the issue that we were struggling with in the Senate when several of the insurers suggested that prices of CGL policies were bound to go up because, you know, payouts were bound to go up. We had two points. Number one, every one of these companies are reinsured for all these pre-1986 exposures anyway. So if they go up, the people who are really going to be absorbing the exposures are going to be the reinsurers, the worldwide reinsurers like Lloyd's of London. The question arises then as to whether some extra dollars paid out in Oregon is going to affect reinsurance premiums when the base is worldwide. The other point that was raised was that notwithstanding the fact that Washington case law had adopted many of the provisions of 1205 anyway, the original 1205, we saw no policy increases among general CGL premiums anyway.
All right, thank you. Mr. Gordon, you had indicated an interest in testifying. Let's conclude with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very briefly, I'm Tom Gordon, an attorney from Portland, and I was involved in the negotiations, so I thought it might be helpful just to clarify the point on the pretender costs. There was another provision of the bill which John DiLorenzo mentioned, and that was originally denominated as Section F of Subsection 4. And that dealt with specifically the reasonable pretender costs. That was taken out as part of the negotiations, and it is the intent, at least from our side, and I believe from both sides, that the defense of pretender is still available to carriers. So in other words, all costs spent before it gets tendered by notice to the carrier can be resisted by the insurance companies.
For the record, Mr. DiLorenzo was agreeing with you,
okay,
so we
good.
Have a concurrence there.
The confusion there was that oftentimes in the policy, that pretender cost defense emanates from the voluntary payments provision. So they're kind of both the same in some respects and different in some respects. And what Ms. O'Neill was concerned about is the leaving in of the voluntary payments, that these costs will not be considered voluntary payments, sort of makes it fuzzy as to whether pretender is or is not in play. And clearly, it's still in play as a defense, and that was the agreement, and it was a very important part of the agreement. So if Mr. DiLorenzo is in agreement, I don't think we have an issue. I just wanted to clarify that. And I would be happy to answer any of the questions, but that was the main point.
PGE versus Bowie would ever let the court look at our legislative history today, why it will be very clear as to what we intend.
Good.
Representative Lowe.
Well, I do have a question in that regard, if I may, please,
yeah.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Gordon. So what you're telling us is that you don't think that this bill addresses the public policy area of protecting companies that go ahead and work with DEQ to mitigate and clean up that would result in a pretender defense or a partial defense by the defender?
No, not at all. All it means is that the insured needs to put, as Mr. DiLorenzo was talking about, needs to put the carrier on notice immediately, because it's the carrier who potentially will end up paying the bill. And he who pays the bill ought to be a part of the negotiations no matter what. So if you're going to negotiate with the DEQ over a voluntary cleanup program, you need to have your carrier in tow with you if you're going to then turn around and ask the carrier to pay for it. The fundamental part of the policy that needs to be protected is that you don't go down, negotiate, pay for 4 or 5 years, and then turn around and present the bill to your carrier and say, oh, by the way. And at that point, the carrier has a pretendered defense. You can't do that. And
that was
the agreement.
As soon as you start playing footsie with DEQ, you'd better let somebody know.
Fair is fair. Representative Uber, I was talking about in the workers' compensation area, that's exactly what's done. You get everybody who's got an interest in this, and particularly the one who's going to end up paying the bill, and you all go down and negotiate together. And that's the point that Ms. O'Neill wanted to make sure was protected. If you're going to ask me to pay, then let me know before you commit me to pay. That's all.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for the testimony on that point, particularly Mr. Gordon. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1205. Representative Williams?
I move the -A10 amendments to Senate Bill 1205.
Representative Williams moves the -A10 amendments to Senate Bill 1205. These are the ones that were introduced by Mr. DiLorenzo. Is there any discussion, any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I move the -A12 amendments.
Representative Williams moves the -A12 amendments to Senate Bill 1205. These are the ones we introduced to us from Powell. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I move Senate Bill 1205 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 1205 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Hawkins, please call the roll.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 1205 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Williams will carry. Concludes the work session, and we are adjourned for today. Committee, we will be meeting at least a couple more times this week. Just watch out for short notice, probably Wednesday and Thursday.